Today, our guest speaker, Reverend Ken Brown, will discuss comings, goings, and the stuff in between. Ken has been a Unitarian Universalist minister for 40 years and the district executive for the Pacific Southwest District for 15 years. Ken and his wife, Tommy, recently moved back to California from Arizona to be near their daughter and grandchildren in Santa Clarita. So let us all welcome Reverend Ken Brown.
Morning. It's good to be with you this morning. The first feeling with many on seeing Mr. King was disappointment. He was so very diminutive, looked so young, and was so very different and outward appearance from what had been expected. The crowd went to hear him out of curiosity, expecting never to go again, thinking perhaps to leave before the service was over. So wrote one of the members of the First Unitarian Church in San Francisco in the spring of 1860 upon the arrival of their new minister, the Reverend Thomas Starr King. After a successful ministry in Boston, King sailed from the East Coast, crossed the Isthmus, and sailed up the West Coast to a new adventure. The writer of the letter concluded with a different observation after Starr King had finished his first service as minister of the congregation in San Francisco. When Mr. King began, there was no restlessness. His voice charmed them, and before he finished, they knew they had a great man before him. One might imagine that the congregation was a bit apprehensive. While King came west with impeccable credentials, in the 1860s, the search process was not quite as well defined as it is today. You didn't have the opportunity to fly potential ministers across the country and interview them. You went completely on recommendations. Of course, a minister had the same limitations in choosing a church to serve. No fancy packets, phone calls, Skype interviews, or visits to the community. Just an agreement to go to a new place as a minister. Yet San Francisco and California benefited greatly by the brief ministry of Thomas Starr King. In fact, even though he only lived for 4 years after arriving in California, he was one of the two people representing the state in Statuary Hall in the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., that is until fairly recently when it was replaced by some former governor of California. I have to admit that King also had to face a bit more than most ministers must deal with today. In 4 years as minister of the San Francisco congregation, he helped pay off the costs of a new building. He led the relief effort to raise funds, more money than any other state, for the Sanitary Commission during the Civil War, the forerunner of the Red Cross. And he spoke widely on behalf of President Lincoln's attempt to preserve the Union. He traveled by stage to such places as Hangtown, Virginia City, and Devil's Gate, where he addressed the miners, many of whom were from the South. They were all armed with knives and guns, we are told, and on numerous occasions they would punctuate his comments with gunfire. With King dying after only 4 years in San Francisco, one has to wonder about the effect of the pressures placed on a youthful minister in that young city. I would hope that congregations today would not contribute to their minister's early demise by standing by while the minister engaged in such strenuous activities. I would hope that a congregation might say something like, "Wait a minute, shouldn't you slow down?" Yet it's often difficult to say such things to a minister. We ministers are often compelled by some unexplainable drive. Those of us who have been called to ministry very often become enveloped by our commitment to this religious movement. In a recent edition of Parabola, David Cooper describes the call as transformative. He writes, "It is an invitation to our souls, a mysterious voice reverberating within, a tug on our hearts that can neither be ignored or denied. It contains, by definition, the purest message and promise of essential freedom. It touches at the center of our awareness." Personally, my call to ministry is really some unexplainable demand to be a minister, something for which I had no clear explanation. And despite a move across country, a move we made in a subcompact station wagon with a teenager, a cat, and a dog, only slightly less perilous than Starr King's boat trip around the continent, I've managed to stay busy with a variety of ministerial assignments. I stayed with the Unitarian Universalist ministry despite offers to work in politics or community organizing, because the call to be with Unitarian Universalists is that strong. Notwithstanding the uncertainty that often comes with being a minister, people are still heeding that call across the continent. There are currently over 400 Unitarian Universalist students in theological school, the majority preparing for the ministry. This is more than twice the number of students when I began school some 40 years ago. Now, not all will make it through school, not all will decide to go into the parish ministry, and not all will be accepted. But there are obviously many folks feeling a call to serve the Unitarian Universalist movement. You represent another part of the ministry, a congregation entering the process of search for a called minister. Though the next couple of years you will be sharing the ministry with an interim minister, one that, as you just heard this morning, is well experienced and has spent the last half a dozen years or so in California, so he's not coming from far away. So this morning I thought, though, I'd give you a sense of what goes into becoming a minister and share a few thoughts on the role of a minister in today's world. It's not an easy process to become a Unitarian Universalist minister. Our congregations and the Continental Association may at times seem rather unstructured. Not so with the process of becoming a minister. In his day, Starr King didn't even graduate from an accredited college. His father was a Universalist minister who died when Starr King was a teenager. He was thus thrust into helping support the family. He later read theology with a friend of his father's and moved into his father's pulpit. Today, a student must be a graduate of a college and have finished at least 1 year in theological school before they are even accepted as a potential candidate for the Unitarian Universalist ministry. In addition to their graduate work, which leads today to a Master's of Divinity, a full 3-year program, a person must also serve in a congregation as an intern for a year and take an academic quarter, what's called CPE, Clinical Pastoral Education. It's an intensive full-time program of working as a chaplain under supervision of an accredited senior chaplain. CPE usually takes place in a hospital. It involves visiting patients and families and spending several hours in group process with a supervisor and often attending classes on counseling skills and techniques. By the way, the student pays for the privilege of being a chaplain, often 10 to 12 hours a day rather than being paid for that work. Then after all that preparation, in either the last year of school or after you graduate, you get to visit with the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship Committee. This is a committee of lay people and ministers that meets 4 times a year. If one is to become a Unitarian Universalist minister, you must be approved by this group. The preparation for the committee means reading a stack of history books, and I mean a stack, about that tall, that you never got to when you're doing your classwork. Writing an essay on ministry, preparing and delivering a 5-minute sermon to the committee, plus an intensive question and answer period. If you make it through all of those steps, you then have the privilege of going through the search process of finding a congregation. Now, there are 2 key roles in the making of a minister that you, our congregation, still have within your authority. One is the rite of ordination. In theory, a congregation may ordain anyone. In reality, we recognize the obligation that comes from such a prerogative and ordain those who we feel are prepared to carry out the ministry of our religious movement. The other action that local congregations retain within our movement is the right to call their own ministers. No one decides this except you. You decide who will be placed in the position of minister within your community. This is a process that you are going through at this time. Sometime in the near future, you will elect a search committee. The search committee will talk with you and get your ideas about what the next ministry might look like. You are taking 2 years to go through this transition. giving you plenty of time to work with an interim minister who will help you look at your congregation and what directions the future might hold. The ultimate choice, though, of who to call will be the congregations. Although we have a well-defined process for the search, which does involve a level of confidentiality when it comes to the search committee's interviews with ministers, the congregation has the final vote. My role will continue to be there with you to answer questions for your leadership and support the search committee. It's an exciting time for you. It's not often that folks get to think seriously about their religious needs and to define the style and type of minister that might walk with you into the future. Enjoy it, and know that the support for the process will always be there. Now, for many, graduating from theological school, passing the fellowship committee, and being ordained is no guarantee that they will find a position in a congregation. Since we have only about 700 full-time positions across the continent out of the 1,000 congregations, the opportunities are often slim. Or, to look at it from another perspective, that's good for you, because there's many more ministers looking for congregations than there are congregations. Being a Unitarian Universalist minister often means living a risky existence. Someone once defined risk as jumping off a cliff and building your wings on the way down. The process of becoming and remaining a Unitarian Universalist minister in the 21st century certainly fits that definition. But for me, there's nothing else I would rather do. The opportunity to be with people struggling for existence in the world is a rare privilege. Whatever contribution I, as a minister, can make toward assisting to create a place that helps people move through our universe is a wonderful and amazing opportunity. There's power in the ministry, one that can go to one's head, power that can become overriding in one's ministry, but the more successful ministers recognize that the power in the ministry isn't because of anything we do. The real authority we have comes from people like you, because of the trust we share as we work side by side to fulfill the vision we have for our religious communities, to create what we need for the future. The reason I decided to leave the parish ministry 15 years ago and to take up the role of the district executive was because I believed I could help build stronger Unitarian Universalist congregations with a shared vision of creating congregations serving people now and into the future. This means having deeply committed lay leaders and well-trained ministers able to share the ministry. So what are some of those key tasks of the ministry that drives those of us crazy enough to answer that call? Joseph Brucock, the American Indian storyteller, wrote something about storytelling that I believe pertains to the ministry as well. After all, the minister is at the core a storyteller, one who tells the story of our lives in our world in such a way that we can grapple with our own anxieties and even our own existence. Brucock writes, "Even though native storytellers work very hard to learn the stories they tell, there is also a sense that the story is given. There's a kind of voice the story has on its own, and as a teller, you both speak and answer that voice." Ministers are storytellers with the responsibility to share through our sermons and other teaching opportunities a vision of the world as we interpret it, as we have experienced it, as we hope it might be. Brucock also speaks to another aspect of the call to ministry that ministers grapple with. He writes, "There's a feeling that you're not the right person to do it. As a child, you are taught to be humble and modest. The stories are powerful. And so you question whether you are doing the right thing." The scriptures are full of stories of those reluctant to receive the call. Moses ran from God. Jonah hid out on a ship, ending up in the belly of a whale. Mordecai Beck, an artist who did a series of etchings for a book about Jonah, writes, "A key that guided the preparation for a representation of the story in etchings was the Hebrew word for big, which appears 13 times in the original text. Jonah feels overwhelmed by the bigness of everything, including his own potential." I know I can only speak for myself, but I believe that those of us who are called to ministry must constantly question and re-explore what that call signifies, what our ministry means. Ask my wife, Tommy, if you don't believe me. In fact, I believe that if a minister ever reaches the stage that he or she is completely sure about what they are doing, this person probably doesn't belong in the ministry. So we ministers have the responsibility to our call and to the people with whom we minister to continually review our ministry and to understand the seriousness of our role. Yes, even in our Unitarian Universalist congregations, we ministers have a role that does carry a certain authority. Now, certainly we are not authorities. We do not tell folks what to believe or what they must do to be spiritually whole. But our role is to help folks take their experience of life and maybe suggest how one might look at a particular issue or concern. Remember, experience is not something that happens to a person. It's what people do with what happens to them. Thus, I believe that each one of you, in essence, writes your own sermon each week based on your own experiential interpretation of what the person in the pulpit has to say. But the role of a minister who works with folks to guide them to making those decisions of what to do or suggesting how to view the world does carry a vital obligation. Another important role of the minister is to respect and interpret our traditions as we see them. Since so many Unitarian Universalists come from other religious traditions, we have to help people understand our proud and historic heritage. It also means staying connected to our religious movement, because just as we gather in local congregations to support and learn from each other, we need also to be connected to the larger religious community that supports us as individuals and the local congregation. Yet in our religious communities, the prerogative of ministry is not just that of the minister. The total ministry of caring for each other, of supporting others in their religious odysseys, and acting on one's faith in the community is not just the function of the minister. Ministry in a Unitarian Universalist congregation is a shared responsibility between religious professionals and lay people. This means that Unitarian Universalist ministers have to be able to work with people in creating a dynamic and wondrous community. Today, being a Unitarian Universalist minister is a challenge, but so is being a member of a Unitarian Universalist congregation. Together, ministers and lay people have the responsibility of building the future. For me, there is no better place to work on the spiritual issues facing all people. In a world that often seems to be coming apart in front of us, what better place is there for taking responsibility for creating something better? If we are concerned about violence in the world, the influence of the religious right, the divisions of ethnicity and the economy, the future of our children or grandchildren, or any myriad of concerns in today's world, how better to give birth to something healthier than being part of a Unitarian Universalist congregation? This is a marvelous congregation with great possibilities before you. It deserves your support and your dedication to participating in its ministry and sharing in the transition that you are entering. I want to close with a quote from the late Jack Mendelsohn, Unitarian Universalist minister. He concludes in his book, Being Liberal in an Illiberal Age, with these words. Human nature and its champion, liberalism, suffer these days from a wretched press. Those who like nothing better than to take control of our lives are palpably encouraged that this is the best of times for fastening to pet pieties and nostrums, orthodoxies and chains. But these will be fatal days for the liberal spirit and for a human nature determined to take control of its own spiritual destiny and biological survival only if this generation is without stalwarts who distill from the essence of the predicament the wonder of halting, imperfect, but coping solutions. I say unto you that Unitarian Universalism provides, not by any means an exclusive, but a special and inclusive place for such stalwarts. These many years of laboring in its vineyards have both chastened and deepened the pride I take in calling it the religion of my heart and my mind. To which I add, amen and amen.
I often find from Unitarian ministers a kind of they formulate a reality in how they and also us as a congregation kind of faces existence in a way. And usually it's framed in terms of the bigger issues of war and strife and justice and things like that, which is extremely important. But if you look at some of the megachurches within the Christian community, you'll probably find that really good preachers are talking about things that help us in our daily life or our relationships with our family, our children, our wife, making a living, health, death, things like that. And I don't see that emphasized too much, but I think it actually is more important. What do you have to say about that?
Well, if you were asking that question 40 years ago when I started out, I would agree with you. But asking it today, I don't agree that most Unitarian Universalist ministers today are dealing with those personal issues in people's lives as they work with the congregation, whether it's through a sermon or through other opportunities. That's what I see happening out there. Like I said, 40 years ago, 30 years ago maybe even, yes. We were looking much more at the bigger issues of the world and concentrating there, but not today. I think you will find, and I'm hoping that your search committee finds when he gets elected and is out there looking and talking to the potential ministers, that they'll find the same thing. That's what I see out there now.